To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
Hey everybody, you know that song, you know this voice. That's right, it's your buddy Rook. And with me, as always, is the man who keeps this show going, the guy behind everything we do. It's Don. How you doing, Don?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. And I cannot tell you how much of a pleasure it is to introduce for the first time, the second time, our guest today, Stu Taylor.
Hello. You're probably going to have to explain what you mean by that as well. But no, it's a pleasure to be here for the first time and back again. There you go.
We had a little hiccup. We recorded together last week, and we only got 18 minutes of conversation. So, Stu, thank you again so much for being gracious enough to come back and talk to us again about this amazing book that you've put together. We're going to gush on it again. Tell us again, how did you come to meet, and what was your introduction to Octaviriana?
Sure. Okay. Well, no, I mean, it's a pleasure to be back again, and I'm always happy to talk about Octaviriana. So doing it again to a receptive audience, that's awesome. So Octaviriana, for those who don't know, and I imagine it's a vast majority, is a 50th anniversary of her original publication. She's like a Russian superhero, kind of Amazonian freedom fighter. The story goes that she was created by an underground group of sort of anti-Russian USSR kids. Used to get together, have these wild sex parties, and come up with these strips featuring their heroine Octaviriana. A guy called Peter Sadecki smuggled these strips out in the late 60s, came to the West, had them published in a book called Octaviriana and the Russian Underground in 1971. He met a publisher, a guy called Tom Stacey, who has like a track record of like publishing quite conservative anti-communist publications. So when Peter turned up at his office, he was like, yeah, this sounds great, I want to publish a book on this. And so the book came out. Like I say, in 71 in the UK, a US printing followed soon after. Maybe a couple of years later, David Bowie came across the book and was inspired by the tales of this, you know, underground youth that really kind of appealed to him. And he announced to the world through, I think it was like either like Smash Hits, which is like a pop magazine at the time, that he was going to do a movie. His on-off girlfriend, Amanda Lear, was going to be the star. He announced soon after that that he'd like recorded songs for it, and then nothing ever happened with the movie. But 80s rockabilly idol, a huge Bowie fan, noticed that this book was a big deal, found a copy himself, was equally inspired by these underground tales, had a tattoo of Octaviriana on his arm, and she featured heavily in his breakout MTV hit Dancing With Myself. So this, you know, this underground group, you know, got notoriety. The only thing is, this whole backstory was complete bullshit.
And here it goes sideways.
Here we go sideways. So yeah, so it's true that Peter Sadecki came to the West, found Tom Stacey, got the book published. These stories of these underground youth, that was complete fiction. And the wild sex orgies, that was all something in Peter's head. The truth is, there was a strip called Amazona, which was kind of commandeered by Sadecki. He got two Czech artists, Bohumil Konechny and Zdeněk Burian, to put together these series of strips based on what Peter was asking. And the idea was he was going to sell this to the West, but he had no luck, and then decided to kind of sex it up a bit and gave her a red star, came up with an elaborate backstory of her origins and the kind of character as a kind of anti-Soviet communism. Which he thought would be more appealing, and he found a willing publisher with Tom Stacey. But the truth is, he basically stole artwork and, you know, became more of a collage of his creation as he went along. This is a very long answer to your question, by the way, but I'm kind of conscious that it's giving you a bit of the backstory here.
There
was a court case prior to the book's publication in Germany where the artists found out their artwork was being misappropriated. You know, they can get a lot of trouble. You know, if you think about living in communist Russia, if you get caught putting out anti-state stuff, that's human on the chopping block. So they did win a court case, and Peter was supposed to give back all of the artwork that he'd stolen and misappropriated. He had given back some, from what I've understood, but the rest he brought over to London in the UK, and then carried on the deception. And of course, being it pre-internet, it's easy to kind of these things to kind of escalate. And the character's kind of lived on as a kind of inspiration for indie comic strip artists. So there was Trina Robbins in San Francisco in like the 70s and 80s who came across the character and believed the backstory originally. Brian Talbot, who featured her as in a cameo role in his Adventures of Luther Arkwright sci-fi adventure series, which is how I first came across the character.
Oh, yeah.
And then for myself, 25 years ago, and then some, I collaborated with writer and artist John A. Short, and we did our sort of American comic book version of the character for a few issues. And actually, I think it turned out to be the first solo American comic book appearance for the character, which we didn't really know at the time. And at the time, I think I believed the backstory until I was at a comic convention and was told quite clearly that it was all nonsense. And it was basically, it's a Cold War comic book con, is how I kind of pitch it. And so here we are another 25 years later, and putting together an anthology for the 50th anniversary for a whole new audience, hopefully.
Were you disappointed to find out the backstory wasn't true?
Yeah, absolutely crushed. I can vaguely remember being sat there, and a guy who was like a bit of a super fan had done some research. And again, this is kind of the internet was around, but it wasn't, the tool.
Right.
Google exists for sure.
Right.
And so this guy kind of came up to me and sort of said, it's all rubbish, right? And then he'd done some digging on Peter Sadecki and found out more about the guy who had a history of deception and, exaggeration and, he used to write a lot of letters. Like, it was like a kind of a condition. He would write long, long letters to people, quite inappropriate in some cases. And he kind of would just rant and rave, and it became quite clear that the guy was probably slightly unhinged, or certainly had a different perception of reality than everyone else. And as far as we can tell, I don't think he ever acknowledged that he was deceptive. His relationship. Sorry, go on.
He really never came out and said, "Hey, I messed up. It wasn't me."
No. I think he got the book published and then disappeared onto the next thing. But his relationship with Bohemil Konechny was kind of like a father son, because I always say that Konechny's kind of like the Kirby of the Czech art scene. And as a young boy, Peter Sadecki was a big fan and kind of made his way to their home and introduced himself to Konechny, his wife, who, as far as I know, they didn't have kids. So he kind of became like a bit of a son. He used to help them with admin stuff with his artwork. And then when he eventually went to the West is when he started the whole, draw this strip and I'll sell it and we'll make a fortune off the decadent West. So I think, from Konechny's perspective, it was a bit heartbreaking. He's obviously betrayed. And it did leave him in hot water when the book came out, because even though he won the court case, a year or two later, suddenly he's getting a knock on the door from the state saying, "Well, we've heard this book is out in the West and it's your artwork." And there was a documentary, a 30-minute documentary in the Czechoslovakia, which kind of went through how this was like a Western conspiracy. They went the other extreme, like, "Oh no, it's a whole the evil West are trying to make us look stupid." And there's scenes of Konechny being presented with the book as if it was the first time he'd ever seen his artwork. And of course, historically there was a court case, so it wasn't news, but he had to kind of feign shock and surprise and was like, "Oh God, this is awful. This is my art, but this is not what I drew, and this is horrific." And from what I've spoken to people before, there were letters where Konechny was like, he didn't say you screwed me over, but it was kind of those tone of like, you've betrayed me, and I think he really ruined him. Yeah, I mean, it did cost him work, from what I understand. Burien, on the other hand, went off, you know, did still have a successful career doing like realistic dinosaur illustrations for like museums and publications.
Those are awesome, by the way. Those are fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, this is stuff I grew up as a kid. You know, this is before CG rendered artwork. This was like real hard stuff. But with Sudeikis, I think he did write a letter, kind of almost like saying you should be. Yeah, you should be grateful. I've given this is great publicity, you know. Never seeing
that, you know, this guy could have died, that they could have killed him for this.
Yeah, I didn't think about that when you said the court case, because. But was the original material really anti-Soviet? Or was that.
Funny enough, you look at. If you're able to get hold of the original book, The Russian Underground, there are only two strips and partial strips of that.
Right.
That are in the book, and they are if you imagine it, it's just literally panels of black and white strip art, and underneath is like typewritten descriptions of what's happening. And both of the strips excerpts are preceded by what went before. This is what happened previously, and then there's like another long-winded what happened next. And they're more. They tend to be more stories of a story. Like the first strip is her, Octavriana, killing a giant radioactive walrus, and yet there's this elaborate backstory about how it's supposed to be. You know, her and her crew are going to try and help this indigenous community, and then the second strip is her, you know, chasing down buffalo on the steeps, and you know, there's a whole elaborate, you know, Western versus China story that he's written, but it's not in the strip. And if you take a step back, it's quite evident, really. He's just making up what the stories are about. It's more like a collage of ideas. You know, he's just taken the artwork and thought, how can I make this fit the story that I want to tell about this underground group?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's disappointing, I think. If you see the book, you'll be like, oh, this is not what I was hoping to see.
Yeah. I looked into the original book, and I can't find it for under like $175, $200. Yeah, yeah. It's very, very hard to find. And the pages that I have been able to see online, yeah, it's like a prose book. It's not like I expected a graphic novel, and it's definitely not that. It's like, okay, this is a thing we did. This, you know, and it was. It was very like, oh, look at us. We were so progressive. We were so cool. We were so amazing. And none of this content is true. It's so wild. getting into your experience with it now, you did a small run of her prior. That you said that was many years ago that you did that.
Yes.
What year was that?
So that had been 96 through to 98. So we did, as an independent publisher, Revolution Comics, we did five issues. Actually, it was a prologue, issue zero as well. And it was split between two stories, one set in the 60s that I wrote, and one set in the modern day, which was late 90s at the time, written by John. And we had like a rotating a variety of artists, like indie artists at the time. And then I went off to do a two-issue kind of follow-up of my side of the story called Filling in the Blanks. And at the end of the day, this was kind of foolishly doing self-publishing right during the 90s implosion. So, you know, just for pure financial reasons, I had to take a step back and couldn't continue to finance my self-publishing side of things. But I did sort of carry on to do like paid short stories for 2000 AD in the UK. I did a number of stories for Warhammer Monthly, which was like the Games Workshop official comic at the time. This was probably going up to almost the mid-2000s. And then life got in the way. I had to get a job that paid the bills. But all in the background, I was kind of still tinkering with ideas and concepts. And my day job is I run an agency, media agency in the UK and Canada, primarily for video games. And whenever there was an opportunity for me to kind of shoehorn comic books in there, I was always finding an angle.
Nice.
And then this year we launched Dead Good Comics, which is like an offshoot of my company, because the Octavriana 50th anniversary has been in the back of my mind for like 5 or 6 years, and I was thinking I need to do something, you know, to celebrate this. And I was working on a documentary back in 2015. And we interviewed a few people at the time, including Tom Stacey, the original publisher of the book, Amanda Lear, who was going to be Octobriana in the movie, if Bowie had ever got around to kind of, well, starting it. I was about to say get around to finishing it. He didn't really start. He recorded songs, allegedly, but yeah.
Brilliant ideas, but no follow through.
No.
You had mentioned a couple of the songs made it to, you think, Diamond Dogs.
I think, yeah, because... the guy I was working with on the documentary, we ended up kind of not doing it because we had very different views. Yeah. He wanted to be more about David Bowie, which was definitely the more commercial angle. But honestly, you know, there's not much you can say beyond Bowie was going to do a movie. He announced he was going to do a movie. He said he was recording songs, but then it didn't happen. So I think if you kind of, you know, positioned a movie on that premise, you'd be a bit disappointed when you find out that there's nothing more beyond that.
Right.
So around that time, he was recording music like quite prolifically, and then there's a couple of like tracks that have made it onto Diamond Dogs, which kind of feel they could have been written for that. Amanda Lear had recorded songs, and I found I think it's like an archive. One of the London recording studios had archive lists of song titles and artists, and there's one by Amanda Lear called Star, which is around that time, and I think she did said in an interview that she'd recorded a song called this, called Star. So we know some material made it somewhere, but right. It just kind of, it never went beyond. I doubt there was even a script even considered at that stage. So
this stuff here, I have to say, in talking to you now, it gets me even more excited. It's, to me, bigger than life, because I didn't know anything about the character until you mentioned it. And 1984, that magazine you mentioned, Smash Hits, it was here in the United States, is Star Hits. And in 84, they had one page of Billy Idol with the Octobriana, I'm saying her name wrong, tattoo. And it had a drawing behind him of it. And he was just saying he wanted to get a tattoo. He said he wanted to get something that really shocked the world, you know, the tattoo world.
Yeah.
And he had that book, you know, in the Russian underground, which... In the United States, the UK, even though we did get Judge Dredd at the time, it could have been the Land of Mu or Oz, you know, to us. But I was like, wow, there's a book about the Russian underground? There's a Russian underground? I was in the Navy at the time, and, you know, communism was just a black thing that you weren't... I saw issues of Pravda in San Diego, and I wanted to look at one. There's no way in hell I would have been able to bring that on the ship. And Howard Chaykin was doing American Flag, which was one of my favorite comics. And I did bring on a ship, but I was scared to death because all the women had hammer and sickle earrings and the Soviet flag was everywhere on it.
Yep.
You know, that was the world we were living in. And I didn't realize there would be an underground. And the character was neat. You know, an Amazon-looking one with a red star. It had a rustic, ruined look to it that I just found fascinating. Magazines just go through the ship, and sometimes guys will see me, hey, did you see this? You know, everybody liked it. There was something about her, and as you mentioned, that Dance With Myself video, it figures prominently. He shows a tattoo she's painted on the side of the building. And I didn't know all the other stuff. I've seen since the comic you did 25 years ago, and there's some other work I've seen.
Yeah, well, there's lots out there. I mean, I think so. John, who I mentioned earlier, we worked with Revolution. He's continued to use the character in a variety of his projects. But what I feel is probably not seen is a lot of the European and Nordic indie comic artists have done a lot of material. I would, from what I've seen, I'd imagine more material over in the non-English speaking comic field of Octobriana than there is probably in the West. You know, I've kind of gone out my way to kind of track down as much as I can. You know, a friend of mine said, you know, do I own every single piece of published Octobriana material? And you know, it feels like it sometimes, but I know there's a whole world still to be sort of discovered out there. And I think it's probably something we should touch on is, you know, she seems to be in the public domain, and I think that's more of it's because it's complicated. You know, if you look at the original artwork, which was a character called Amazona, the very few pieces of art you can find has like an upside down triangle on her head, and it was a very different type of strip. the whole backstory that Sadecki brought to the table is another layer on top of that. He drew his own panels to fill out certain areas. The German version of the book was actually more of a traditional graphic novel album and was quite blatantly pornographic. He added in a whole scene of her masturbating with a buffalo horn, which to me kind of smacks. Yeah, it's quite, you see it, you're like, oh, right, okay, he's gone there. But the artwork is so different, and it's clearly he's gone, well, this is, you know, I can get away a lot more over here. Maybe that's what they want to see. Yeah, that was a bit of an eye opener. So, you know, it's layers upon layers, and there's like a university lecturer, and a bit of an Octopriana expert in Prague, who I met a few years ago when we were working on the documentary, Thomas Pospisil. And something he said to me is kind of really stuck, where he was saying Octopriana is more of a collage. You know, it's like, you know, no one really owns it because it's like a layer upon layer of basically, you know, there's originality and then there's just myth and deception. Mm. You know, so no one really owns it because it's like you try and pick it apart. And it was a conversation I had with like a film lawyer when we were talking about the documentary, because that's one of the things we were going to, you know, need to kind of clarify is where do we stand legally. You know, we wanted to get the film distributed, and you know, the two lawyers I spoke to were just like, don't even know where to start, like this just looks like a minefield, you know, because the last thing they wanted to have is someone come out of the woodwork and go, oh, you know, my great grandfather drew that line or whatever. Yeah,
well, and that's one of the complicated pieces with her is that, you know, she, you can't really nail down what she who she belongs to, because so many people have added to her. And yeah. But what you've done with this book is absolutely fantastic. You've really created a great jump point for people who have never heard of her before, like I'd never heard of her before before this. And you know, you lay it out in such a brilliant way in the book to be able to show who she is, where she's from, her origin story, you know, and you definitely leave me wanting more. Yes. In the book that you presented. Now, this was a Kickstarter that you did, and from what I see, it was a very successful Kickstarter. You sent us an amazing amount of stuff. I mean, just I absolutely just love all the stuff that you sent. You sent a temporary tattoo, which now is hanging in my wife's tattoo shop. Amazing. Yeah. When I finally showed her that, I was like, hey, check this out. And I was like, it's based off of Billy Idol's tattoo, you know. And she's like, oh, that's mine. That's going on the board at work.
Just explain what happened. When we were set up to do this interview, they sent us digital copies, which I always appreciate, so we could be familiar with the material. And then they sent the Kickstarter package. I wasn't expecting it, but it's a square-bound comic. And I have to admit, that is some of the slickest packaging I've ever seen. It comes in a nicely perfect folded-out box with a Dead Good Comics tape on it. And it's just full of swag. It's got a set of cards. It's got the temporary tattoo, which I was going to keep, but I thought of Rook's wife, and I thought, no, she needs to have this. I kept the Michael Cho Mylar sticker. But it was... My wife was making fun of me because I'm 60 years old, and I'm sitting on the couch with my feet up going through this stuff going, I was like a little girl, you know, oh, look at this, you know. And even though I read through the digital copies and I ready to talk, I read the comic book. Maybe it's my age. There is nothing like reading a real comic. I appreciate getting digital copies, but the real comic, and I passed it on to Rook, same thing. Fantastic package. Fantastic.
No, thank you. And I think that's, you've kind of hit a couple of things there that are probably worth addressing. Like, for me, I did kind of dabble with digital comics as a kind of reader and collector. It's not the same. There's certainly the convenience factor. But I think with this package, you know, as a new publisher, and you know, the printers we work with here in Canada did like such a fantastic job. Yes. That I felt it is better to kind of have that physical product to kind of show that we delivered the goods. And a lot of the extras were, you know, were a way of thanking, you know, Kickstarter supporters. I wanted everyone who got their comic to feel they got good value for money, for investing in someone who was new. So yeah, it was fun to put together. And actually, the tattoo, there's a bit of a meta story behind that. So you've got, if on our main cover, which is by Marguerite Sauvage, she's got a Billy Idol tattoo.
Yeah.
And so the actual temporary tattoo we gave away with every copy is designed by a Montreal tattoo artist, Angus Byers, who based it on Billy Idol's version of the tattoo, which was also based on a bit of artwork from the original book. Now, in one of the strips, we've got Billy Idol teaming up with Dr. Brianna on the Sunset Strip, and it ends, it's not really a spoiler, but that strip ends with her getting a tattoo of Billy Idol and him getting his Dr. Brianna tattoo. And the artist has drawn Angus, who's our tattoo artist, giving Billy Idol a tattoo. So we went really meta and deep and Easter egg-y on that one. So
fantastic. I love that.
Yeah, that was awesome.
There's little hidden things, you know, just a nod to friends, to people, you know, love that. I actually, when you told us that last time, I had to go back and open the book to that page, and I'm like, hey, that's pretty cool.
I didn't tell him actually until we got the final artwork back, and I said, hey, you're famous. You actually gave Billy Idol a tattoo. So you could proclaim that now.
That was a nice touchstone in the book. I really enjoyed the comic. The different artists you have, I don't normally like it when you have... I like one team. You know, it's just me. Although, yeah. I have liked anthologies like the Heavy Metal magazine and stuff like that. But I normally tend to like one team through it. This one, I have to admit, even though the styles were different, they all worked together.
Yeah, well, and the story structure of why it changed was brilliantly done, too. It's very accepting to the mind to see such a change in artwork style with the way the story was done. So, you know, I really applaud that as well.
Well, it kind of made you see why.
And that was very much, that was the hardest thing, I think, was trying to get my head around how we're going to put together a book for a first-time publisher. You know, I wanted to make, you know, literally reach out to known established professionals and, you know, kind of say, hey, you don't know who I am, but here's what we're doing. So I did put together like a pitch presentation about, you know, this is the greatest Russian superhero you've never heard of, and here's why you should be excited. So for it to work, you know, the idea with the framing was it starts in the near future. Octaviano and her underground crew have to rescue someone, and things happen that she ends up having to relive past memories, past adventures, and it gave us opportunity to do a series of like different stories from different artists and also different writers. You know, we've got Stephanie Phillips, who's currently writing Harley Quinn. We've got Andrea Towers, who wrote a book called Geek Girls Don't Cry, which was like a look into how iconic fantasy superhero characters influence us and the impact they have. So it's getting different voices as well, and then it was like a kind of an eclectic mix of artists. So, you know, we've got Simon Fraser, who draws our main story. We've got Mark Lamming, does our World War II strip. We've got N. Stephen Harris, does our kind of crazy 80s era satanic panic televangelist weirdness. We've got, you know, Andy Bellinger illustrated our origin story, and that's actually based on a text origin of Octaviana from the original book. Going back to what I said earlier, like Peter Stecky wrote a lot about what the comic strips were about. He would describe, you know, in a few sentences, these crazy scenarios, but they were only written in text. They didn't exist in strip form. It was literally him just making up.
Just creating in his own head and putting it out there.
Well, that adds to the mystique, too, of it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So with his origin was, you know, she was, you know, millennia old. It was like the child of like a Viking and you know, a South American priestess or princess. You know, if you do a bit of history, they don't even match up time period wise, but hey, I make a nod to that in the story to kind of say this is the reason why these disparate time periods have met. So we did the origin there, and then there's another long-winded bit of prose where it's like a poem, an excerpt of a poem that Sadecki had claimed that this underground group had written. So we did that as like three double page spreads. We broke it down and just, you know, I approached very different artists and said, here's an idea for a two page spread. This is the word, don't have to match it. so accurately. Let's go crazy. Let's kind of give a visual. Anything's possible, you know, really, with this. So,
Every artist that you had in the book, they're at the top of their game on this. I can't stress this. The first story, this isn't a world I want to live in, but it was awesome. And, you know, it was a place that was horrifying, but it had airships going through it, and it was believable. Fantastic design. All the drawings are spot on. The story had me caught up. And one thing I really like, again, adding to the mystique of it, was the main character is drawn differently throughout. Even in the old strips you talk about, the original strips from the Czech artist, she's really kind of primitive and rustic looking, you know, more like you'd think from the Amazon. But it changes, and some of them, she looks like she's a girl from Malibu. And I accept them all. Each one is a little bit different. I find it fantastic. And the comic itself, you have a couple of illustrations by the original Czech artist, I think. Am I correct?
We do. So, we do have a page which is from the Radioactive Aura story I mentioned earlier. We kind of did it as a full page, and I just, like a kind of bridging between two stories, I kind of made up a story to kind of go with that. That wasn't based on the original material. It was something I'd originally come up with. And then the back cover, is another piece of original artwork that's been coloured. And in fact, both of those pages were coloured because they're originally black and white. So Pippa Boland did an amazing job on bringing those to kind of life, really. Because that's something I would like to do, is actually go back to the original strips and bring them into comic book form, traditional comic book form. It's a project that's on hold at the minute, just because, you know, we're focusing on Octobrana with Love, and also spoilers, two more specials next year as well. So
that's fantastic. That you know, and like I said, at the end of this book, you definitely left wanting for more and some explanation, because you do add in some original characters to your story as well, which, like, I'm watching them interact with her and everything, and I'm like, okay, well, I get that's Rasputin. Is that a talking gorilla?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, all right. You know, and I'm like, okay, where do these fall in? And I'm trying to figure out, like, from any original information, I'm like, okay, I don't know. And then last time you mentioned they were original creations, I'm like, okay, now I get this. All right. So,
yeah, I mean, for sure, I kind of wanted to kind of give people a bit of a crazy ride. Like, it is kind of jam-packed for the 64 pages we put together. And it's kind of nice to hear the feedback from you guys that it kind of made sense, because that, I think, I've been so close to it that I lost perspective, I think, a long time ago, really, because it's just, you know, it's been a real challenge putting this together, because I think, you know, considering it's the first comic I've published for, you know, 25 years, I went with a big beast of a graphic novel with multiple creatives in such a kind of challenging environment as well. So, hey, you know, my pandemic time's been well spent, I think.
Yes.
I would say so, because I really think you knocked it out of the park. You really did.
Thank you. Testament to the creators as well. They brought their A game, really, and, you know, they took a chance. You know, it was like, you know, I had no track record really to speak of. I think the only creator who has a bit of a history is Simon Fraser, who drew the main strip, and, you know, he said to me in an interview that kind of stuck with me as well, and he said it was kind of, for him, it felt like a bit like unfinished business, because he's was doing a strip called Nikolai Dante for 2000 AD, which was set in a futuristic Russian sci-fi environment. Octobriana had a very brief cameo in that series, but he hadn't actually illustrated that. And personally, I feel the character got short shrift. It was kind of four pages and she was done, but she wasn't really based on the Octobriana from the book. And I had seen an illustration Simon did many, many years ago, and when I started putting this together seriously, and to the point where I was ready to kind of reach out to creators, he was genuinely the first artist I approached, because, you know, I thought I'd love to see him do a whole strip, and he's been a great, you know, collaborator. And yeah, I hope that will continue. We've got plans for the next one, but I won't go into much detail yet. Don't want to spoil that. So,
I guess one question I have. You mentioned it earlier about on the public domain, but have you run into issues with it, like it's been done in another book and you're afraid to try to use it, or was that a thing? Was that any...
I think with this, I mean, the way I approach it is go to the source material. Like, luckily, I guess, there's only one book, and that is Octopi and the Russian Underground, and there were two strips, or bits of strips, and that's it. Like, anything laid on top of that that we've done is our creation. So it's, you know, the things that are kind of iconic are her outfit. Like, her original outfit is her with, like, the leopard tail hairband.
Yeah.
The snakeskin pants, the snake charm bracelet. It's like the radioactive necklace, detector necklace. And she wears a scarf across. It's not very, it doesn't give a lot to imagination. So one thing I think we wanted to do was kind of make her a bit more practical.
Right.
So we getting like torn sort of anarchy t-shirts and, you know, and in the strips, like in the World War II one, she's wearing a big sort of shearling winter coat and like traditional Russian style hat, winter hat. So anything from the original is fair game. But anything we've layered on top of that is kind of our own creation. And you mentioned the supporting cast, so our version, you know, Rasputin's obviously in, you know, he's a public figure, so he's not owned by us, but our interpretation of him and the way we present him,
right,
would just be, there'll be more to come in future books. And Tarquin was the original creation. Lucretia, who's our new character in the book as well, that's original. And the Wonder Machine, the circular travelling machine, that was in the original book, but once we eventually get to see inside that, that's going to be our original version of that, because that was never seen.
Right.
You know, and the modifications we've made to her outfit, you know, that stuff there. I mean, it is messy. If someone wanted to come in and sort of jump on board, they'd have to go to the source, and then it's pretty much fair game really from there.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't be able to build on what you've done. That wouldn't be allowed. They'd have to go to the original source material.
Well, yeah, I think legally, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we're going to have different creators working with us, but I think if someone came on board and saw Octopi with Love and went, right, I'm going to just continue that story, that would be copyright infringement, right? So, yeah. But, you know, because you see the characters appeared in so many different ways. I mean, last year, indie artist and cartoonist Kayfabe, Jim Rugg, did his own take on the character. It's like, so I really highly recommend. It's like a blacklight comic strip book, and it's just crazy. She's taken on like a robot Stalin, and from what I remember, the visuals of his, they're very much based on the original book, like the original costume, original outfit.
Yeah, it appeared to be, from what I was able to see of that. And it's fascinating that everybody's got kind of their own take on her, and you know, your design, your look that you've created with all the artists that worked on this book, it's, while each one is original and different, it still follows through in a cohesive manner, and it really brings it all together. I can't say enough great stuff about, like, you know, how, because this is a completely different and new thing for me. I'll be honest with you, when we first got the email, I kind of looked at this and I was like, is this some like super pro communism propaganda piece somebody's trying to get out there? And then I started looking into it, and I'm like, well, like, I want to talk to this guy just over the history of this character.
Yeah.
That alone, like, really hooked me in. And then when we got the digital copy, it was like, oh, wow, this is straight up, like, somebody took a serious amount of time and really made an amazing book here. And, of course, like I said, then we got the Kickstarter package, and I was even more blown away. But... this is going to go out to with Diamond Distributors, so people are going to be able to get this at their local comic book shop soon, but they can also order it from you directly as well, correct?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So it goes on sale officially through comic stores on the 22nd of December. We had that confirmed recently. The whole supply chain shortage nightmare meant that our comic store version has kind of been slightly delayed. But you can buy it direct from us. We have a website, octobriannacomic.com, and then it's / Octobrianna store. And we have the Kickstarter version, which has like a nice spot gloss varnish on the main character on the front.
Yeah, that's and that's kind of a lost art, the varnish. I don't see that.
It kind of goes back to my background. I used to work in magazines. I used to love that stuff. You give me like nice printing finishes, and I'm just like happy. You know, so for me, it was like, I want to do it. I had no idea how much it would cost. Actually, it didn't turn out to be too expensive, you know, on a unit basis.
Right.
But for the comic store version, it's just there hasn't got that finish on it, and there's a different back cover artwork and a different color spine. But that's really just to kind of appeal to the collector mentality that I certainly have as well. So there's different versions, and the Michael Cho cover we were selling through Kickstarter, and we can sell it through our store, but that's through the comic stores. That's like a retailer incentive, where if they buy our regular cover by Marguerite Savage and our variant by Joyce Chin, which had a retro 1970s Marvel feel to it,
yeah,
they have multiple copies of that, they'll get the Michael Cho one as well. So you know, we've been playing that game just to kind of as everyone else does, I think. But actually, I just want to go back quickly about the character as well. Like, because it was a story of a story in the original book, you know, this is what the characterism was. There was no real characterization of her. So something that I've certainly taken, is to kind of ask about what is it going to be like for someone who's lived for so long? Because the idea that she's, you know, these thousands of years old, it's like, I imagine your memory's a bit sketchy. Like, I have trouble remembering what happened 5 years ago. I can't imagine what it's like trying to remember what happened 200, 300 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the fact that she's kind of portrayed as quite violent as well, it's like, she's obviously slightly scary, slightly crazy. So I've kind of, you know, the personality we've put in there, that's something that's original to us as well, our take on her.
Right.
We don't have her talking in like comedy Russian. And that's a very deliberate thing, is because I was thinking about, if you're that old, if you're millennia old, you wouldn't have a funny accent. You'd know how to speak English, or you'd know how to speak Russian or German or French. So I, you know, in my voice, I hear her having a kind of weird accent.
Right.
But she doesn't talk like, you know, with comedy Russian accent. I just think that wouldn't.
Yeah.
You'd have picked it up by now. It'd taken you 100 years, mate.
Yeah, like, you'd pick up whatever you're around.
Yeah, and I kind of, for me, it was looking at, of all things, the original Highlander movie. Yes. There's a bit of snippy dialogue when one of the cops go, you've got a funny accent, where are you from? And he's like, lots of different places.
Yeah.
It was a way of kind of saying, you know, it's a French actor trying to put on an American accent. The reason why he sounds a bit weird is because he's so old and he's lived in different places. So that's something we brought, you know, to the table with this, is our take on the characters, you know, slightly different, I think. Over the top, a bit funny, but also hopefully a bit scary, like ultra violent and scary.
Yeah, yeah, no, I definitely think you nailed it on that. Yeah, there were several things that I definitely laughed at. her on the motorcycle with Billy Idol was
right. That was fun. That was fun, right?
It's a fun ride. It's a great read. I can't tell people enough times that you definitely need to go and, you know, hit your comic book shop, go to the website. Definitely, you guys want to have a copy of this book, because it's a lot of fun. You know, we see a lot of different people doing, you know, self-publishing books, and you know, sometimes pieces are problematic, or, you know, the end product is not exactly what you thought it would be. This was done with attention to detail in every single aspect, and, you know, it's worth twice as much as what you're selling it for, honestly.
I have to agree with Rook on that.
Oh, I appreciate that. I don't think I can get away with that, but I'll take it, yeah, for sure. If you want to pay double the amount, I'm happy with that, yeah.
But one thing on this book as well, I didn't mean to interrupt, but if you like this, there's a lot of backstory from other sources that you can find, work that Stu has already done before. You'd mentioned the Jim Rugg book. I didn't look at that purposely. I saw it online, but I was wanting to focus on this one. But they also have a YouTube show they do with I can't remember the other man's name.
Ed Pisker, right?
Yeah, Ed Pisker.
Yeah.
Cartoon Cafe.
Yeah.
And they do a thing on Octobriana, and they show some of the stuff on there. I'll have it linked on the blog, but it's worth checking out. The Russian Underground book was on David Bowie's 100 Books You Should Read.
Yeah, yeah.
And I saw it somewhere else as well. Again, this is something I never read, but I'd seen it. Like I said, the Billy Idol connection. I didn't realize it was the same thing when Bowie talked about it. But it's been around. One of the guys we do the podcast with isn't on this one, but he was collecting Luther Arkwright. He always talked about it. I never read the book, but reading your introduction to the comic, you mentioned it. So I had talked to Dallas. I said, she was in that book. And he goes, oh, it's been, you know, I got to read it again.
Yeah.
How much was she in the book? Because I've seen samples of the pages, which I found kind of, she was the primitive rustic looking Octobriana. Yeah.
And that was very much, visually, I think it's pretty much exactly as she appeared in the original book. So Brian Talbot, so it's magnum opus. She appears, I think, in issue 2 or 3, or both. And she appears on the cover of issue 3 as a kind of cameo role, like an action role, and you know, he portrays her as quite brusque and a bit earthy, saying quite, you know, forthright and sort of violent. And I guess, you know, that probably has paid an influence a little bit on our take on her as well. I think from what I understand, like at the time, I think Brian Talbot believed the myth and the backstory. Obviously, I know he doesn't feel that way now. And I think when we were doing our book, and funny enough, he drew the cover for our first issue. You know, and I remember actually he gave us photocopies of the original book before we were able to track down a copy. So it was a great source of, you know, inspiration, and was really supportive of what we were doing. I think he was just happy to see the character live on beyond that. I would say track down Luther Arkwright. It's a great read, nonetheless. You know, she's only in a spit and a cough, as we say over here. So that's definitely worth checking out. I'm trying to think of anything else. A lot of it is just going on eBay and just searching and trying to track down. I would say do get a copy of the Jim Rugg one. He did it in 3 versions. He's got the Blacklight version, which is eyeball melting in a good way. I think he did a regular comic store, a regular comic version, and like an 80s style black and white pulpy version of it, the same strip but in different formats. Which, if you love print as much as I do, they're all a joy to read, really, and they're well worth kind of tracking down.
That's something else. You know, when you just said that he believed, the guy that created Luther Arkwright says he believed it but he doesn't know, I hate to say it, I still want to believe it. It's
I do too, you know, honestly. Well, I still feel disappointed 25 years on when I found out it wasn't true.
It's one thing, ruins inspire wonder. When you see old things that are broken up, there's something fascinating about that. It's like there's a story you're not quite seeing to it, and that's how I take it with this. And I'm loving some of the stuff you're talking about, how her mannerisms and her speaking, you know, accent would be different from all the places she'd been. She belongs to the world. Also, memories getting confused and mixed up with everything else. It's kind of like leaving food open in your refrigerator and it picks up all the other taste in it. It could be horrifying. Sometimes it's wonderful. But yeah, I'm really excited about this thing. I'm excited to find out you're doing more.
No, thank you. It's something that, you know, we're well into doing the first special, which will be like a summer special, which picks up pretty much straight after our kind of deliberate cliffhanger. So we're going to go into more detail about Octobriana and her relationship, and Rasputin and Tarquin, their relationship. We're kind of adding more depth to those. I kind of don't want to give too much away. I'm kind of conscious of what I'm saying.
Right.
Please be, because I definitely want people to be.
But I think we do tackle on, you know, I do tackle how her first response is like just to kill. You know, anyone gets in her way, she'll kill it. And I think there will be a bit of a confrontation with that between her and Lucretia, who's like a new member of the group, and how they see that and think they think there's another way around it. But one thing we haven't really touched on with the book, and I'm kind of avoiding, is the whole like communist stuff, because again, that was an elaborate layer that Sadecki had added onto the character, because there was nothing in the original strips that she was, you know, banging a drum for communism. I feel that she would represent the spirit of that, where everyone's equal, but it has kind of become, you know, perverted over the years. I think as soon as you get people involved with anything, no one's really going to be equal. Someone always wants to be, to have more money or have more power, so it's always going to be corrupted. One thing Sadecki said is she kind of flits between sides, like one day she'll be on this side inciting revolution and the next she'll be on the other. So I'm going to kind of tap into that a bit. But, you know, it's funny, when we first started the campaign on Kickstarter, we were promoting our Facebook page, and some of the comments we were getting were quite, like, funny now, but yeah, there were like death threats and people saying you commie bastards, and it's like, well, look, you haven't seen the comic, and you know, and it's just people react. I think the Red Star and, you know, the notion of her does generate responses in that way. But my argument is, like, you know, it's like saying Captain America represents whatever president's in power. It's a nonsense. He doesn't represent that. He represents, you know, the people. And I think we've got to be able to represent the oppressed is our take on it, really.
Right.
And whether there's, you know, fights to be had, or, you know, people to be freed, then she'll be there with guns.
Right. I didn't realize that. So I thought originally, again, the Billy Idol tattoo, I thought that she was revolutionary, but sometimes she went on the state side.
Well, that's the thing. It's when Sadecki, I wish I'd copied the book. The last one I had actually gave to a Kickstarter backer. Ones were in the UK. But there was, Sadecki would write about the stories. He would say, there was a story about this, there was a story about that. And then there's a whole thing where he's talking about, you know, one time she's on the side of the Chinese, you know, Liberation Army, and the next she's, you know, funding, you know, the freedom fighters on this side. You know, it's just kind of like she's kind of changes like the wind, really. And he just wanted to kind of make a sound that she was slippery, and, you know, you can never kind of pin her down onto one agenda. But I just think that was probably him not really knowing what would appeal. I think from going by the fact that it was all a myth anyway, and he wanted it to be commercially viable, he probably wanted to say whatever would sell the book.
I got
it. Seems to be like it, yeah.
One time, when I was on the ship, I subscribed to Time magazine. This is when Gorbachev, you know, came into power. And I was reading an interview with him, which I found fascinating. But then it had more stuff about the Soviet Union and everything. And I stopped after I read it. I was just sitting back, and one of the officers on my ship said, "What are you thinking about?" And I told him what I just read. I says, "You know, I never thought about it. This is communism is actually supposed to be like Christianity. You know, everybody helps each other out. Everybody's part of it." And then he said, "Well, that's ideal communism. You know, what you have is true communism, you know, the military and all that." But I find if I ever said this to somebody that was affected by communism, let's say they came from Vietnam or, you know, in Cambodia, any place where they get really defensive. I mean, and I understand why. They get scared to death. But the idea, when Habitat for Humanity down here in the United States, some of the people behind it were on television back in the 80s saying, well, people keep coming up to us and says, well, this is communism, what you're doing. And they said, this is in the Bible. You help each other out. I mean, I understand where people are coming from on some of this stuff, but, I mean, it's a real hot topic here in, you know, the United States right now.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting sometimes to see a different perspective on it. I'm not looking for it, but I find it interesting. But the character, I like what you've been describing, because she basically belongs to the world, and you can't define her. You know, she's bigger than life. She's open source. Everything you talked about, she's an open source comic book character. And even bigger than that, she was The Russian Underground book, to me, is like a design book that was really popular in the 70s and 80s. You know, I what I've seen online, I really liked.
No, absolutely. I totally agree with everything you said there. I mean, I think she does belong to the world, like the, you know, because it's such a multi-layered origin of, and it's a mess, you know, that I'd love to see if this does anything, if it inspires a whole new generation of cartoonists, comic writers, comic artists to go and track down the original book and do their own take on the character. That's great. I'd love to see that. And it's, you know, she certainly deserves it. You know, we're going to carry on doing what we're doing on our little corner. You know, I can say that we're not going to get heavily political because it's not something that I feel makes for good comics. I think, you know, we're just going to be over the top. We're going to tap into that side of the character and adventures, and, you know, we are going to tackle the fact that she incites these revolutions but, like, doesn't seem to kind of, you know, clean up afterwards. So, you know, we're going to have those kind of questions, but it's not going to get particularly deep. At the end of the day, you know, she's a superhuman, time-traveling butt-kicker. So, you know, don't expect heavy political theories or discourse from us on that one. So I'm probably doing myself out of sales there, but hey, if you if you're looking for that, you don't want to check out our book.
No, that's perfectly fine by me. I need to escape that right now.
Right, we all do.
Yeah.
Do you have plans to do other titles with Dead Good Comics, or are you just going to focus on this?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so saying what I said earlier about how we are a video game PR agency is one of our main parts of our business. We have a number of clients who are interested in doing comic book adaptations of their properties, so we are having talks with some of those right now, and hopefully we'll have something to announce in 2022. But that's the ambition. You know, we're going to do Octobriano's original material. Another reason for doing that was to show to, you know, prospective clients what it is we can do and what we can deliver. Because the conversations I've had over the years have been, you know, people saying, oh, I'd love to do a comic book, but not having an understanding of what's involved, from the pure granular stuff of, like, costs involved and the schedules and the timings. You know, you can't just turn a comic around in a few weeks. You know, this can take months. Yeah. Artists, you know, need time. You know, it's people are not having that understanding. So having a physical product now has certainly helped, you know, ground people in reality. So yeah, the plans for next year, we're going to be at some shows in the US as well as Europe, as long as things keep opening up. We're looking at Heroes Con in North Carolina.
That's a great con.
Yeah, and again, it was literally me just looking at the calendar and thinking what was going to be a good show to be at. And also we'll do Montreal Comic Con, which is where I'm currently based. We'll do that in the summer. New York Comic Con is definitely one we want to try and put on the list if we can get in there. And we'll be doing a couple of the Comic Cons in London as well, in the UK. Yeah. So we'll have a presence next year.
Yeah.
And like I say, by the end of next year, we'll have 3 Octobriano books, all being well, under our belt. So.
Wow.
Fantastic.
That's awesome.
You know, I think you got a bright future with the character and, you know, the company. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you guys are producing in the future. Put it this way. You kind of screwed yourself because you put this out as your standard. Like, hey, look, this is what we do. Now that's the expectation.
I think you can keep it up. It's a nice pad all the way through. Everything on it was just and artfully done. There was nice design, artfully done. It was just great fun. I loved it. I look forward to more of this. I guess I could ask my comic shop to carry this because it's got time right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why not. So if you go to our Twitter account, actually it's probably the best, so it's twitter.com Octobriano Comic. I think our pinned tweet will have the diamond ordering codes on there. So not knowing too much of what's involved now, I know that, you know, it's going to be on sale very shortly, so whether it's still able to kind of put orders through us via diamond. We certainly have copies. I've got copies here, so I'm more than happy to kind of provide direct if diamond are a bit obstructive. But yeah, it's any comic store should be able to sell us and stock us.
Fantastic. Well, I told you before, I have passed it to my friend that works at a comic book shop. I didn't pass her all the goodies.
Points, I said, yeah.
I did pass her the book and the paper talking about ordering and everything. So actually, I got to get back by and check on her and make sure she didn't take off with my book.
Well, no, but any comic stores listening, if they want like some promotional items like the tattoos and stickers and postcards and trading cards, you know, do kind of get in touch with me on like social media. And, you know, we still have them here, and I'm more than happy to help stores, you know, give the book a push in any way possible. Ideally it'd be nice to kind of do some signings as well. So I have ambitions of doing a bit of a tour next year once things are opening up. Yeah. So, yeah, more than happy to help promote if stores want to stock us.
All right. Nice. Now, on the blog, everything we talk about will be on there with links. And you have mentioned the Octobriana comic on Twitter. Last time we talked, which we lost, you said you could find you on Twitter on STOONAMI at Twitter.
That's right. Stunami, yeah, that's my personal account.
So. Oh, I got you. Stunami.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
It went over my head Stunami the first time. Stunami
Menace, for those who remember that channel.
Yeah, that was nice. Okay, we'll have that on there. I want to say there was something else I wanted to ask, and I can't think of what it is. It must not have been very important. Anything else you want to wrap up with, Rook?
Go for it.
Okay, any further things, Stu? This is your second time.
Not for me. I think we've covered all the bases there. I really, really appreciate the time to come on and just talk about the book. And it's really nice to hear your feedback, because genuinely, you know, we've got books out to Kickstarter backers, and it's, you know, it's rewarding, but it's always nice to hear some feedback. Like I said, I've been a bit too close to it, so I'm glad you like it.
I know that feeling when you're sitting there staring at it and you hand it to the next person and they go, hand it off to the next. Yeah, I got to tell you, it's fantastic. We really enjoyed it.
Awesome. No, it's lovely to hear. Thank you.
All right. Anybody listening, we use fake comic book covers on the Facebook page and the Facebook group. If you'd like to draw one, we're always looking for stuff. We can't pay you for it because we're cheap, but it's yours to own. And if you allow us to, we'll add it to the cover gallery of the blog. We didn't have a music break on this episode, but we're always looking for musicians, singers, performance artists. If you got a recording, we'd like to play it. Nobody thinks they're any good. When I have gotten a couple of things, they say, well, I don't know if you want to use it. We're happy to use it. We've gotten feedback. Everybody likes them. Just put it out there. That's all I got, Rook.
Guys, make sure you check out our website, bunchofdorks.com. You click on the Cyclops. It's got all the episodes there along with the blog. Our YouTube channel as well, Two Dimension on YouTube. You can see Dallas doing his Pull-a-Palooza and me doing my In the Collection videos. We'll have more of those coming, many more of those coming in 2022. Until next time,
read
more
comics.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Two Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
As you heard earlier, we lost the first recording we did with Stu. On that recording, Boba Fett from Star Wars is mentioned. After we finished off mic, I had asked about what was the appeal to the character. Stu suggested we should record that, and we did, and that 18 minutes survived, and even though it has no relevance to what you just listened to, here's the three of us talking about the appeal of that character I've never understood. Enjoy it. All right, we've ended the show, but I want to ask Stu a question. It's something he said earlier.
That's over here trash-talking Boba Fett.
Stu had mentioned he liked Boba Fett, and I was asking, What was the appeal to it? Now, I explained why. I was 16 years old when Star Wars came out.
I can't see my Star Wars stuff. And I try to angle my camera to my Star Wars stuff.
Star Wars, when it came out in 77, it rocked the whole planet. It shook, it tremored, everybody was freaking out about it. They put out action figures of Star Wars. My little brother was getting them. My cousins were getting them. And after the movie had been out about a year, they started advertising, if you got so many proof of purchase from these characters, you could get a Boba Fett figure. I guess he was on the Christmas special they showed that everybody hates
on
now.
Oh, God, no. We're not talking about the Christmas
But that's, I think, was where he appeared. Now, my cousin, you know, who's quite a bit younger than I was talking about it. To me, Boba Fett was like a bunch of reject pieces from other figures they didn't use, and they put it together. Now, he showed up at the end of Empire Strikes Back. But basically, all he said was he wanted his contract fulfilled, and he took, you know, Han Solo frozen in carbonite. Well, then he appeared in Return of the Jedi, and he died. I mean,
no, he didn't.
He was at the end of one movie, showed up at the beginning, and I thought, well, that was a letdown. But whenever I talked to, you know, small kids, or people that were small kids when I was watching these movies before, their favorite character is Boba Fett and Jango Fett. So I just lambasted a beloved character that a lot of people love that I never understood. So I'm asking Stu, who I've just met, to explain to me the love of Boba Fett.
Wow. I'm never coming on this podcast again. I'm just being
so You ruined it, Don. You ruined it.
But I think, honestly, I think you've kind of given the answer. So the first Star Wars movie for sure that I saw in the cinema was Empire Strikes Back.
Okay.
And I remember cutting out the action figure cardboard names and then doing the mail-in for Boba Fett. I remember seeing the adverts in like the UK comics at the time. So at a very impressionable age, there was this mystery character that, you know, you had to go through a process to get, and then you'd wait months, and then this little white cardboard box would arrive that you'd forgotten about, and then inside is his action figure, it's his Boba Fett. So there was that kind of I don't say it's risk and reward, it was like, you know, sending off your little cardboard back and, you know, your couple of dollars, a couple of dollars, and then hoping you'll get something back, and then this coming back, this mystery gift. And I think, you know, again, it's such a long time ago, but I imagine I had that excitement around this mystery character, and then seeing him on the screen kind of compounded it. I don't think we ever got the holiday special in the UK, and I certainly never saw it. The first time I saw the animated appearance of Boba Fett was this year or last year on Disney Plus, when they actually put that part of it up. Hmm. Obviously, the rest of the holiday special is like they're just denying it ever happened. So I think with that, it was just like, you know, I played the Star Wars figures as a kid, and I'd concoct these stories around the characters. So, you know, the reality is that Boba Fett had minutes of screen time, but in my mind, I had this whole universe around him, and he just looked cool.
Right.
And you were right to say that he was made up of rejects, because I think the original concept was he was going to be the new Stormtroopers. And I think originally he was white. It was going to be like the upgraded Stormtrooper, but they couldn't afford to do more than one. And so they just gave him a spray paint job. And I think George Lucas was like, that's cool. I'll make up something on the spot. And then, hence, that was Boba Fett. But I think the mystery side of it appeals. And then linking it back to comics, it's like why I was fascinated by Wolverine, because there was a mystery. You didn't know his origin. You didn't know how old he was. And, you know, you were a bit intimidated by him because he could go completely wild, and then he'd show a softer side. So there's like layers and layers. And with Boba Fett, you could create an entire backstory because you didn't know what was under the mask at that point with the original trilogy. And, you know, what was his beef with Han Solo? You know, what was all that? And they've kind of explained a lot of it now, which I think takes it away a little bit. But I'm like super excited for the new Boba Fett TV show. I'll be there.
Yeah, the book day one. Yeah.
But I think it's a time and a place, and I think also with Star Wars, and I'm probably going to get shot for saying it, but I think you have to see Star Wars as a young kid, a very young kid. Like, if you watch it as an adult, it's trash. Like, the dialogue is not great. You know, the story's not great. but I think you have to be at a certain age. It's why you watch, you know, if you watch like films you watch as a kid, as an adult, and you go, oh no, that's kind of, that's not what I remember, that's not great.
Oh well, yeah, that happens. But I will say, when Star Wars came out, the first three, everybody wanted to see them, including my dad, who didn't like that kind of stuff.
And oh, wow, okay.
When everybody left the theater, my mom, the first time my mom took my brother and I to see it. Now, my brother's 5 years younger, but all three of us left glossy-eyed. It was a movie everybody went to see. And I would have teachers in high school who, again, didn't like comic books, didn't like Star Trek, didn't like any of the stuff that I loved. But they'd always say, have you seen Star Wars? Take your family to see it. It was wonderful. I worked for a guy at a dry cleaner that he didn't like Superman. He didn't like, he liked reality. If I'd see a dinosaur movie on TV, I'd ask if he'd see it. It was either yes or no, I like to live in the now. But he went to see it. And again, he was, everybody, especially the first one, but the first three, everybody was just glassy-eyed after they saw it. It didn't matter. My grandmother went to see it, and she was talking about it. It reminded her of the old silent serials when she was a kid.
Right.
So, you know, there was something about it, and I do think there is a certain age for it. But again, Boba Fett was one I never understood, because if I talked to any of my friends' kids, or I was at a comic store, and it was next to, it was basically in a Latin shopping center. You know, a lot of different, we're in Florida, a lot of Spanish-speaking people down here. At a restaurant, grocery store, all that. And this one man came in with his, I think, 7-year-old son, and he wanted some Star Wars comics. So the guy showed him a few. So I'm sitting there, you know, talking to him. I said, well, who's your favorite character? And it was Boba Fett and Jango Fett. And I said, what do you like those so much? And he thought, he goes, well, they're bounty hunters. Okay, I understand. But I mean, I hear that all the time. Who's your favorite character? When I was there, it was always Darth Vader or, you know, Han Solo or something. But younger, it's always Boba Fett or Jango Fett. And again, to me, Boba Fett showed up at the end of Empire and died at the beginning of Jedi. What am I missing here? So, okay.
I don't know. I always dug him. I mean, of course, I was born in 1980. So, for me, I got to see the movies as a very young kid. And, you know, Boba Fett was fascinating. I mean, he was this guy that took out one of the main characters. Yeah. Even though he didn't technically do it, he was taking Han back to Jabba, and it was like, oh, what's Jabba? What is this? And and I don't know. He had a mystique about him. Mm. He did, and I think that's why the Mandalorians as a whole, appeal to so many people. There's just something about the look of them, the way they move, the way they talk. They're just cool, man.
No, it is. I think with him, it's very much like it kind of taps into the man with no name, the kind of real Western, cowboy Western aesthetic. And I think that's probably why I loved like the Clint Eastwood movies growing up. I think now I look back and go, well, yeah, I like Boba Fett, so it kind of makes sense that I'd like that kind of genre as well. So I don't know, Don. I'm very disappointed, but it's fine.
Listen, Rook is on your side, so don't hold it against the show.
Listen, if Dallas was here, he'd be going off on a 30-minute tangent about how great Boba Fett was, because Dallas is like the ultimate Star Wars fan.
Okay, you guys have been enlightening. I have one more question related to Boba Fett.
Sure.
Now, my daughter convinced my wife and I to go see Not the second trilogy. I did see those. But after Disney bought them, what was the first movie they did?
Force Awakens?
Yeah, was that The Force Awakens?
Mm-hmm.
And I got confused, and nobody's explained it to me. At the beginning of the movie, he was one of the main characters. He's a stormtrooper. He takes it off. He was the guy that was so sweaty, didn't want to be a stormtrooper.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, I thought the stormtroopers were all clones of Jango Fett. Of this guy is not.
Yeah. No.
What happened?
Well, that goes back to the original trilogy, right? I think they've kind of explained that the clone troopers were eventually replaced by normal people, although we never see it. Just, I think they're always trying to kind of retroactively explain why, if you watch the original trilogy, why stormtroopers are different heights. Because it's like they're not all Jango. But I think a lot of that was in the expanded universe stuff. Like, they didn't really explain it. But it's interesting you say that, because that always frustrates me, I think, when people, you know, you watch the movies and you may not want to read the comics or read the books. So I think the movies do need to be tell a clear story. Like, so Solo, I know you spoke about it on a previous podcast, but I really like Solo, and it frustrates me that it kind of ends on a cliffhanger where there were supposed to be two other movies. And also, it brings, again, this is, anyone hasn't seen it, sorry, but it brings back Darth Maul, who moviegoers will know is dead. And so, you know, I know there's, it's explained in the animated series, but I always felt that was a bit lazy. It's like, look, don't assume that.
Yeah, it was for kids, though, so kids don't mind lazy writing.
Yeah, yeah. I did like the Solo movie quite a bit. When I say this, and I don't mean, I know a lot of people love all these movies. I like the original trilogy. I haven't cared for the newer movies, but I mean, that's just me. But Solo, my brother wanted to see. My brother's a musician. He's in an orchestra, and he loves the soundtracks. And he says he liked the second trilogy because it was original story. But no matter what, he likes the music. But we went to see Solo, and I really enjoyed the movie, and I was shocked to find out it was basically didn't do well and was trashed. And I thought, and I came back home, I was in Texas at the time, I came back home, was talking to Rook. I just assumed Rook went to see it at midnight when they released it, like you do every other movie on the planet. And Rook hadn't seen it, and Dallas hadn't seen it, and I'm like, really? Well, they've seen it since. I think you both liked it. I think we talked about it.
Yeah.
But I never would have thought I would have seen Han Solo not played by Harrison Ford, and I liked it. And I thought it was great. I thought the story was neat. It told a backstory. I really enjoyed that quite a bit. But it didn't bring up any love for Boba Fett.
No, that's fair. I was actually disappointed that Boba didn't appear in it at all, but that's by the by, I think.
If you think it's weird not seeing Harrison Ford play Solo, wait until you see Sebastian Stan playing Luke Skywalker.
Oh, I've seen the kind of fake.
Photoshopped deepfakes.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes. I'm in for the ride, you know. We'll see what actually happens with it all, you know. So, I've enjoyed Mandalorian so far. I'm looking forward to the Ahsoka series, and you know, Book of Boba Fett. I mean, I'm chomping at the bit.
No, I'm really, really excited about that. And I think the last trilogy was disappointing. And I think for me, it was as much as the stick that the prequels get. It was a clearish vision that George Lucas had of a story arc. And that's something that I feel that the last trilogy was, they were just chasing their tail. They were like, oh, this hasn't been well received, let's do this for the second one, and then that wasn't as well received, let's pretend that never happened. And then it just, narratively, it just didn't make any sense, and it was just a mess.
Well, I think they failed is that there's so many novels and comics that went past where the movies ended, and they took all of that good stuff that the really deep fans loved and went trash can. They went, okay, that's all, like, you know, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, and here's what we're going to give you instead. And the fans expected a little more from the novels, the comic books, into the final trilogy. Yeah. And they didn't get that. And I think that's where Disney owning the property really went wrong, is that they didn't play fan service in the final trilogy.
No, I feel they did in the last one. The last one they did, I think that's where that was a mistake, I thought, where they were just like, the Last Jedi was so poorly received, and I actually kind of liked it.
Yeah.
Like, for me, the Last Jedi, I saw that and then saw the reaction afterwards, and I was like, oh, I kind of... I think the reason why I liked the Last Jedi was it felt like a surprise. I didn't feel I knew what was going to happen next. I feel that it would have been good to have a bit more Luke. I kind of get that. Yeah. But then, yeah, the Rise of Skywalker to me did feel like a bit like fan servicey. It was like, remember that bit you liked from this other Star Wars movie? Here it is again. but it just didn't. It's like, you like the Emperor? Here he is again. Don't ask questions. Don't ask why. You know.
So, yeah. Well, yeah. It's. I think they were trying to fan service it, but they didn't give enough explanation on to, because like, if you've read the books, you know all the backstories and the reasoning, and you know the Emperor's personal Star Destroyer with all the clones of himself in it and all that weird stuff, you know. But what we got with the Rise of Skywalker just kind of was like, all right, well, we know you guys like this, so here it is. We're just going to hand it to you, but not explain any of it, really. So yeah, I think that's where they really went wrong in that final movie. But you know, I mean, overall, it is what it is. It's now out there, and you know, if you really don't like what you got from the movies, there's a lot of really great novels.
Oh yeah.
Oh, there's a lot of Star Wars stuff. It's really popular, and I will say that I didn't care for the Marvel comics for the most part. There was a few issues I liked, but the Dark Horse stuff. Really something.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I haven't read any of the Marvel got it back, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah.
But the Dark Horse stuff, I found the stories were neat. The artwork was staggering. And it was neat. So
they get some great stuff. And bringing it back to Boba Fett, the Marvel relaunch back in 2015-16, went into my local comic store and didn't realise they were doing a special Star Wars day, and behind the counter was Jeremy Bullock, the guy who played Boba Fett, so I got my copy signed by him. It was kind of surreal because it was like, oh, hi, do you want your copy signed by Boba Fett? It's like, sure.
Well, I would have said yes too. Are you kidding? Yeah. So yeah, call me a hypocrite, but yeah, it's okay, that's been fantastic. All right, well, another mystery has been solved in my life, so.
There you go.